Hey everyone, and welcome to another episode of On All the Rise Disclosure. I'm Kevin Gastola, joined by Rania Kallick. Hey Rania, how's it going?
Hey, it's going well. How's you doing, Kevin?
It's good to be here again, and we are very pleased to have as our guest Andy Worthington, who is a journalist and activist. He's a co-founder of the Close Guantanamo Project and or their campaign, and he has a website over at andyworthington.co.uk. Did I get that right?
That's right.
Yep. All right. And welcome back, Andy. It's been a while since we talked with you, but it's good to be catching up with you on what's happening with Guantanamo.
Yeah, thank you. Nice to see you both. And I'm very glad that you've invited me on. Thank you.
Yeah, it's it's no easy topic. I would say that it's a thankless gig to cover Guantanamo all these years because there's just a lot of excruciating pain and suffering that comes with detailing these stories, but it's quite crucial to keep describing it. But at least for the start of our conversation, it would seem to be a somewhat positive development that perhaps some reality has reached in within the naval base at Guantanamo with a judge who recently ruled that Abd al-Rahim al-Nashiri, the accused al-Qaeda bomber of the USS Cole in 2000, that a military judge there, Colonel Lanny Acosta, threw out the confession that was obtained through CIA torture. We know vividly some of it, but you could recall it if you would like some of the gruesome details. But that this evidence that was going to be used against him in his case has been tossed out on the principle that you can't use evidence obtained through torture. So, I mean, what's your response? What's your reaction to seeing this unfold at Guantanamo?
Well, the main point of this judge's ruling is that he's thrown out the prosecutor's reliance on a confession that was made by al-Nashiri to alleged clean teams of FBI and NCIS interrogators who interviewed him after he arrived at Guantanamo and got him to basically repeat the same things that he had said when he was being tortured in the CIA black sites. Now, the information obtained while he was being tortured and quite horribly tortured for nearly 4 years in the CIA black sites is obviously fundamentally unreliable. And the use of torture has essentially derailed any prospect of there being a proper judicial process for these men ever since they arrived at Guantanamo in September 2006. But the U.S. government has attempted to overcome this by having interviewed them non-coercively at Guantanamo in the months after they first arrived there, and has suggested that as a result of these interrogations not involving torture, they are fundamentally reliable. And what the judge has finally done is to say no. The damage that was caused by the torture is such that you broke this man so fundamentally and inculcated in him complete compliance to the people who abused him so horribly that this was not given of his free will at all. This is basically a confession that that he was kind of made as a kind of puppet to repeat what he was told because of the fear of recrimination and the damage that had been done to him. And I think it's really hugely important because I think it fundamentally undermines the entire military commission trial system, which, has been a dismal failure ever since it was first established, but which the government still kind of clings to as offering the promise of some sort of successful legal outcome. And I think that's absolutely shattered. And I very much hope that what we see from this is the collapse of the entire military commission system and plea deals being arranged for these men who are accused of crimes at Guantanamo. There are currently 9 men facing charges because it simply now seems impossible to reconcile the use of torture with a legal outcome that will be in any way acceptable.
You know, in your piece on this, you noted how this wasn't covered by the mainstream media. And I'm just curious, you know, if I didn't know any better, if I just started reading, you know, a lot of mainstream media stuff, if I just got into news, right? If I'm like maybe a younger person, I wouldn't even know there was anyone left at Guantanamo. It's like it's not, it doesn't even exist. Can you talk a little bit about the way this has just fallen out of the entire media apparatus as if it doesn't, I mean, politicians don't talk about it anymore. Even the idea of closing it doesn't come up anymore. It just is. It's like, and I think I might have mentioned to you this to you the last time I had you on, but like I do have like nephews and nieces who don't know what Guantanamo is because they were born after 2001. And you know, by the time they like have a memory of anything, it's not, you know, that word was just not, you know, a word that they ever heard.
Yeah, sure. I mean, you know, I mean, it's been a problem throughout Guantanamo's history that people haven't really been very interested in it. You know, the al-Nashiri ruling by the judge has actually secured a significant amount of brief mainstream media coverage, you know, I'm glad to note. It's rare, and it's also, you know, I think so fundamentally uncontextualized that most people won't really pay any attention to it. You know, I can't really begin to explain how profoundly shameful it is that people don't care about what's been done in their name at Guantanamo and formerly in the black sites for such a long time. And, you know, and I think we can see that from particularly this year. There have been a number of devastating opinions and reports issued by various UN rapporteurs. We've had, you know, we've had three opinions, one from a number of rapporteurs and two from the Working Group on Arbitrary Detention, about the appalling conditions in which men are held at Guantanamo. And I mean that not just in the physical sense, but in the failure to provide any kind of adequate medical attention for people, even those who are severely ill, and the entire broken nature of what purports to be the underpinning of the detention system at Guantanamo, as well as things like the fundamentally profound isolation of these men who are barely allowed any kind of contact with family members. I mean, the list kind of goes on and on. But there have been devastating rulings issued in the case of, you know, the first CIA torture victim, Abu Zubaydah, who's still held without charge or trial at Guantanamo, in the case of Abdul Rahim al-Nashiri, and in the case of a man who is, you know, severely physically disabled at Guantanamo. And then came a report by the UN a UN rapporteur who, for the first time, visited the prison in February this year. Now, you know, according to the UN special mandates rules, you aren't allowed to visit facilities and to talk to prisoners unless the party holding them agrees that you won't be monitored. And that's the reason that the UN haven't visited Guantanamo at all until this point. And, you know, and what she concluded was also absolutely devastating, that this is a prison where the systems that have been set up and that have largely not changed over the years from the horrendous brutality of the prison's founding, despite some tinkering by the Obama administration and by the Biden administration, the place fundamentally remains so lawless that it is a place of abuse that may rise to the level of torture. And that's fundamental for the entire place. And yet people aren't interested, you know, as far as I'm aware, her report didn't get very much mainstream media coverage. And, you know, and again, another problem is that even if things do suddenly surface in the mainstream media, they then promptly disappear the day after everyone's moved on to something else. There's no way of remaining focused on issues to require anyone to do anything about it. And of course, the situation's been complicated in the States ever since Obama became president, in that there are certain Republicans who have decided that that anything that moves towards justice at Guantanamo, closing the facility, releasing men, is something that they can score points on by attacking the administration. And what we have now is, with the Biden administration, is that they learned lessons from Obama, who was very upfront about wanting to close the facility and then failed to do so. Everything that he's doing really is below the radar, so no one's noticing. Now, this may be helpful in some ways, but in other ways, it just keeps Guantanamo invisible. And actually, within the administration, there have to be people who have been shaken to some extent by the absolute justifiable ferocity of these opinions and this report by the UN rapporteurs, as well as by this ruling that has just been made in the case of Judge Acosta, who's, you know, this is not somebody from outside the United States is looking. This is an actual military judge in the military commission trial system at Guantanamo, who has said pointedly to the Biden administration, this has been going on for too long. This entire process is discredited because it involves efforts to overcome the use of torture on men, which has rendered from the very beginning the possibility of bringing justice, you know, absolutely null and void. So I don't know what else to say, really. You know, how is it that issues like this remain so peripheral or completely ignored by people? It's a shame at a very fundamental level. Obviously, it says something shameful about the state of the US political media in general. It says something shameful about the state of politics in the United States. But I've never been able to understand really fundamentally the absolute lack of curiosity on the part of so many American people about what has been done in their name at Guantanamo and previously in the black sites for over 20 years now.
One of the defects is that mostly when there is any coverage of Guantanamo and the failures or the dysfunction or the abuses of the military tribunal system, that it's filtered through this, what's going to happen to 9/11 victims? You know, don't they deserve justice? They haven't been able to secure any convictions of the men who allegedly perpetrated these terrorism attacks over two decades ago. Or what about the soldiers who we deployed to Iraq and Afghanistan? You know, what is it worth to them? But without considering that, you know, by and large, we really have a paltry and obscene record when it comes to Guantanamo, right? There were nearly 800 men that were rounded up and brought to Guantanamo. There's maybe, like, you can give us the exact statistics, but it's got to be less than a dozen people here that have ever been convicted. And I'm seeing, you know, that, you know, even those people who are convicted, there are terrible abuses of power that are central to their case. For example, the New York Times, owed to the singular work of one reporter, Carol Rosenberg, you know, without her, the New York Times probably doesn't pay any attention to Guantanamo, but rejected that this prisoner, I don't know if you're familiar with them, but Ali Hamza al-Balul is the only prisoner serving a life sentence at Guantanamo. His lawyers continue to appeal his case, though, seeking new sentencing because they believe that there was material or evidence obtained through the use of torture or cruel and inhuman treatment that should have been thrown out, and that he, you know, had his due process rights violated. Yeah, I'll let you jump back in and respond to any of those points.
Well, I mean, al-Balul is in a, you know, is in a terrible position because he, you know, he refused to mount a defense in his trial, his military commission trial, which took place at the end of the Bush years, so 15 years ago. And having refused to do so, then he was duly convicted on the claims that he was involved with al-Qaeda and made a video glorifying their actions. And was then, you know, received a life sentence, which he has to serve in isolation in Guantanamo. Now, what the administration intended to happen was that the block in which he was held in isolation would fill up with other men who had also been convicted in the military commission, so that he wouldn't be in an appallingly isolated position. But it turns out that he has actually spent nearly 15 years in complete isolation. Occasionally, other prisoners who have agreed to plea deals in Guantanamo have passed through and then been released. But the fundamental position is that he's entirely alone. And this wasn't even decided in advance. It's a byproduct of a failure of the system at Guantanamo that nobody else ended up spending, serving sentences alongside him. His isolation is accidental, but it's very real. And profoundly unfair, I think. He's an exceptional case. He's the only man held at Guantanamo who's serving a sentence as a result of the military commissions. There have only been eight convictions in the military commissions throughout their whole history. Six of those were agreed through plea deals, and some of those have subsequently been successfully challenged. The military commissions are an absolute failure. And so we get back to this point where the best way forward, in fact, the only way forward, is for there to be plea deals. But as you noted, Kevin, plea deals have been mentioned in the last week, and most of the mainstream media in the United States have taken this position of, oh, but what about these people who need justice for what happened on 9/11? And they're completely failing to understand that there cannot be justice through a trial at Guantanamo, because the trial system is absolutely fundamentally tainted by the use of torture, which is incompatible with justice. So the opinion they're taking is, but we know the government told us these were the bad guys. We know that they were the bad guys. So we're actually deeply frustrated at being told that there needs to be some form of acceptable due process before they can be convicted. They're failing to understand the message that the reason these people can't be convicted, the reason that trials cannot go ahead, is because of the use of torture. And at this point, plea deals actually look like the answer to everybody's questions. You're only going to get men to accept a plea deal on the basis that they will make some kind of confession about what they actually did, so that there can be some kind of actual closure. But I mean, there's nothing about this that's going to satisfy those people who say, we know these are the bad guys. We don't really need the whole due process thing. They should be executed. They must be executed. The death penalty has to be off the table. And the plea deals are the only way, as I see it, that we may actually one day be able to see the end of Guantanamo.
I'm also curious, you mentioned earlier about the UN Rapporteur reports. And you've been covering those. Can you talk a little bit about what these UN rapporteurs have found when it comes to Guantanamo?
Well, I think one of the things that I found the most disturbing was that if you go back to Guantanamo's earliest days, where all of these men who were held there, the majority of whom, as we now know, were nothing more than low-level foot soldiers, in many cases were civilians rounded up by mistake. Very, very few of the people held at Guantanamo have ever been able credibly to be described as people who had any kind of significant role within Al-Qaeda or the Taliban or associated forces. But from the beginning, everybody was treated, as Donald Rumsfeld said, as the worst of the worst, and were brutalized accordingly. So the endless surveillance of them, I mean relentless surveillance of them, the fact that whenever they're moved around anywhere on the base, they're still shackled as though each of them poses some existential threat to the people detaining them every single second of their existence, in complete defiance of the fact that most of these men were never any kind of significant threat to the United States. And they're getting older and older, and they're getting more and more ill, and yet no one has replaced the system. So the rapporteur just found that this systemic process of brutalization carries on at Guantanamo. despite Obama having come in and tried to improve things to some extent. There's been tinkering, but the fundamental basis of Guantanamo is still this this endlessly brutalizing, isolating place. So, you know, another thing is that the men at Guantanamo cannot have family visits. Let's say they're from a family where, you know, that has sufficient money to be able to afford to go and visit their relatives in Guantanamo, which, as far as I understand it, is, you know, kind of a requirement of prisons everywhere in civilized countries that they're allowed some sort of family visit. It is simply not allowed. What they're allowed now, if they're well behaved, is you know, short and supervised video calls with family members. That's the only concession that there has been. And it leaves the men at Guantanamo in an endless situation where they're meaningfully deprived of any substantial family contact, which is, you know, which is a form of mental trauma. You know, those are a couple of examples. I mean, you know, what the rapporteur also highlighted was how every claim for there to be an acceptable legal process of dealing with these men's cases is broken, has been broken from the beginning. Habeas was broken by appeals court judges who brought it to an end. The review processes within Guantanamo are not and have never been legally binding. That's the particular problem at the moment. The periodic review boards established by Obama were responsible for clearing prisoners for release. 38 men were approved for release under Obama and freed from the prison. And since Joe Biden got in, he's recognized that, he finally recognized that holding people indefinitely without charge or trial is that there's something wrong with that.
Right.
And he has sped up the process of encouraging, I think, the PRBs to approve more men for release. But these are not legally binding decisions. They're purely administrative. The men cannot go to a judge to ask the judge to order the United States government to release them if, as is happening, the United States government has ended up dragging its heels on releasing these men. The men approved for release in Guantanamo have been waiting between over 300 days and over 900 days to be freed since these decisions were taken. And there are three men approved for release who were approved for release early in the Obama administration who are way over 4,000 days now in the amount of time they've been held since they were told that the US no longer wanted to hold them. So the process means nothing, you know, and the rapporteur very clearly recognized that. And it's why the Working Group on Arbitrary Detention has been so involved in Guantanamo, finally focusing on it this year to demonstrate that actually everyone who is held at Guantanamo is being arbitrarily detained by the United States. Because the men who have been put on trial or have been put forward for trials are caught up in these endless pretrial hearings. So that's not a form of justice, that's arbitrary. And everybody else who's held at Guantanamo is also, you know, even less deprived of anything that purports to be a judicial system. So, you know, it would be hard to think that there has been a more devastating year for international and domestic condemnation of Guantanamo. And yet we're still seeing, you know, nothing really from the Biden administration.
And Abu Zubaydah, it's important to raise and put that into context. I know that there was recently a posting, it was in June, that the Periodic Review Board made a, these are their words, final determination that pursuant to executive order, the continued law of war detention of the detainee remains necessary to protect against a continuing significant threat to the security of the United States. But what we know in vivid and gruesome detail from the torture study that was commissioned by the Senate Intelligence Committee, as well as other reports, whistleblowing by people like John Kiriakou and others who have detailed who Zubaydah is and who he isn't. I mean, this is someone who should have long ago been freed, but your comment on what Zubaydah is caught up in at Guantanamo.
Well, he was, you know, seized in March 2002. They alleged that he was the number three in Al-Qaeda. They completely ignored some US intelligence operatives who knew that that was a lie from the beginning. They brutally tortured him. He's been at Guantanamo since September 2006. He has never been charged. They haven't got a case against him. They've walked back from everything over the years about him being the number three in Al-Qaeda, about him knowing about 9/11. This is a man who was the facilitator for a training camp that wasn't aligned with Al-Qaeda. We know all of this. The fact that they haven't charged him means that we know they haven't got a case against him. The UN working group opinion about Abu Zubaydah a few months back was absolutely devastating. You know, again, all of these opinions this year have been absolutely devastating. And yet, Abu Zubaydah's last PRB took place in July 2021. And as you've just noticed, Kevin, it took nearly 2 years for the board members to rule that they want to carry on holding him because they think he still constitutes some kind of threat. That's an insult. That's a slap in the face, actually, to the UN Working Group on Arbitrary Detention, because this decision has taken place after that. And the UN Working Group made absolutely clear that every aspect of his imprisonment is arbitrary. There is no possible justification for holding him. The only exception would be if they were to finally charge him. But they're not going to charge him. So what we particularly see with Abu Zubaydah's case, again, is the horrible face of torture once more re-emerging very publicly. And this is because in Abu Zubaydah's case, while he was being tortured, the CIA agents who were torturing him sent a message to Langley wanting reassurance that this man would remain incommunicado and detained for the rest of his life. Now, at Guantanamo, he's not entirely incommunicado. He has lawyers who represent him, and when they can, through this veil of secrecy that surrounds the high-value detainees at Guantanamo, exactly because they were tortured, they have been able to tell the world something of his predicament and of, you know, the man who was tortured. But fundamentally, it's very difficult to escape the conclusion that he is still being held because of what he knows about what was done to him, because the United States has no case at all for putting him on trial. So they're holding him to keep the torture secret, even though so much of it is out in the public domain. And it really is time for this this gulf between the government's obsession with secrecy and the absurd situation that we're in, where so much of this is public knowledge and verifiable, to come to an end, and for the United States to acknowledge the horrors of what it's done at Guantanamo and bring this place to an end as swiftly as possible.
Just to move the conversation along here, I'd like to dive into the cesspool of Republicans that are lining up and failing miserably to close in on Donald Trump. And it certainly looks like we will get Donald Trump as a nominee, barring any radical transformation in the Republican Party to where they actually care that this person is facing four indictments which amount to 96 felonies. And so that's that political party in America's problem at the moment. But Ron DeSantis has emerged as a figure with a connection to Guantanamo. So I'd like to just play this clip of him being asked and then get your response, because we didn't have a chance to talk with you yet about what's been emerging about DeSantis's past history at Guantanamo Bay as somebody who was a soldier assigned to Guantanamo, and the fact that we have seen some Guantanamo detainees speaking out about seeing Ron DeSantis at this base. But Here he is. This is from a few months ago. He's in Jerusalem, and a reporter asks him, I just think we should include his reaction to this, because it seems to really vex him. It really gets under his skin that he's being asked these questions.
Okay. No, no, none of all that's BS. No, totally, totally BS. Yep.
You
say you
were president.
Yep, yep. Who said that?
Detainees.
How would they know me? Okay, think about that. Do you honestly believe that's credible? So this is 2006. I'm a junior officer. Do you honestly think that they would have remembered me from Adam? Of course not. They're just trying to get into the news because they know people like you will consume it because it fits your preordained narrative that you're trying to spin. Focus on the facts and stop worrying about narrative. Yes, sir. Yep.
All right, there's Ron DeSantis, and that's how he reacts. And I'll also throw in that apparently people connected to him or people who support him were able to successfully suppress a Vice documentary that would have examined his alleged actions at Guantanamo while he was there among prisoners.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I'm not sure that he appears to be coming across that confidently. So, you know, which I think may be a problem with him rather than in relation to this Guantanamo thing, because if he'd played it correctly with Republicans, you know, that could have been a positive thing for him, that he'd been in Guantanamo allegedly abusing prisoners. As for the Trump thing, Kevin, I really hope not, you know, for pretty much every reason that I could possibly conceive of. But for the topic we're discussing today, Guantanamo, Trump's 4 years were a total disaster, and an absolutely unacceptable, unprincipled disaster. He effectively sealed the prison shut. Only one man was freed during his 4 years in office. Only one man was approved for release. It was disgusting and disgraceful how he treated Guantanamo, as though it wasn't the absolute horror story that it is. I also, if I may, Kevin, I just wanted to go back to what you were saying about Saeed Baqoush, because that claim about al-Qaeda came from his intelligence file at Guantanamo. And this has consistently been a problem. I very much doubt that US officials in person said to their Algerian counterparts, you know, this man was connected with al-Qaeda. The problem is that whenever prisoners are released from Guantanamo, the receiving country receives the information about them that was compiled about them in Guantanamo. And these are files stuffed full of lies. These are files stuffed full of statements that were made by other prisoners when they were in situations in which it's reasonable to conclude that they weren't under any form of duress. So torture, you know, as we've discussed, is not just something that is related to the high-value detainees at Guantanamo and the black sites. Torture and other forms of abuse that erode the credibility of statements that people made absolutely bleeds through the entire story of Guantanamo from the very beginning. And actually, you know, we've seen, I'm pretty sure that some of these problems are still happening now, that the State Department and their official who has been appointed to try and get these men approved for release out of Guantanamo is still dealing with the same issues of handing unreliable intelligence files to prospective countries who are then turning around and saying, well, why on earth would we want to take this person? Because you've just given us a file that tells us why they were a significant terrorist and all of that. And it you know, it's fundamentally unreliable. Most of it is lies. So there's a bigger question here as well, I think, which is that at some point the United States has to take responsibility for its abject intelligence failures throughout the whole of the war on terror when it comes to the black sites and Guantanamo. It's something they won't want to do. It's something that I don't think will be easy. But this is the entire history of Guantanamo and the black sites is one of those generational black marks against the United States, which happens has happened throughout the country's history. You know, this is comparable to the internment of Japanese Americans during the Second World War and the long, long struggle it took for there to be accountability. But it's absolutely true that Guantanamo is a horrendous crime zone, and that there has been no willingness at all on the part of the US government to address quite how fundamentally they messed up everything when it comes to rounding people up and imprisoning them. And it needs to happen. And, you know, unfortunately, at the moment, there seems to be no possibility that someone can intervene in this process of attempted resettlements from Guantanamo to say publicly, by the way, we know that these files are fundamentally unreliable. We admit it. As always throughout Guantanamo's history, getting any admission of wrongdoing is next to impossible. And I'm pretty sure that the reason is that every transaction, every discussion that is taking place behind the scenes that we can't see has lawyers involved. And lawyers will say to everyone involved in any of these processes, do not admit that we made mistakes. Do not admit that we did anything wrong, or we will be sued.
Well, I think that we have to basically like wrap up here. I'm just curious, like, for those who want to get involved on this issue still, I know that Amnesty does a lot of work around Guantanamo, though I personally am not entirely sure of like who else is doing any stuff on this. So for those who are listening or watching who want to help, what can they do to be active on this issue?
Well, you know, obviously reading what's available and trying to disseminate it as widely as possible is helpful. Kevin, at the start of the show, mentioned my website, andyworthington.co.uk. I hope people will visit. I have been doing this for 17 years, and I think I've amassed an archive about Guantanamo, which is unparalleled. I also run a website, closeguantanamo.org, which is dedicated to the closure of the prison. And, you know, and I run a couple of public things that that are attempts to keep Guantanamo in the public eye. So one is a photo campaign that I've been doing for many years now. So via the Close Guantanamo website, I have a poster for every 100 days that Guantanamo has been open. And I encourage people to take photos with it and to send those photos in so that we can show the breadth of international support for the closure of Guantanamo. So the next poster is in is on August 28th. It's 7,900 days that Guantanamo has been open. I hope people will want to take part. And also to take note that, you know, in 3 months' time, it's going to be 8,000 days. So these kind of round figures, I think, are particularly powerful. So I hope people will take part in that. And in February this year, I also established monthly coordinated global vigils for the closure of Guantanamo, which take place in a number of locations across the United States and around the world. It's the first Wednesday of every month. And people gather together and take photos calling for the closure of the prison. And I think those photos gathered together, you know, really help to show that, you know, that this is an issue that people still care about, not just in the United States, but around the world. And, you know, those are the things that I suppose I'm most interested in trying to promote. I mean, I'm working here in the UK with MPs to try and get them to try and put pressure on the government. That's an uphill struggle given the extreme right-wing nature of our government at the moment. But I've also been working with MEPs in the European Parliament to try and get European countries to get more involved. And we're going to be having a meeting in the European Parliament with former prisoners and lawyers and MEPs to try and raise that particular issue, which is happening at the end of September. And if people watch out for those websites, then the information about that will be forthcoming soon.
Well, thank you, Andy. It was really good to talk with you. So thank you for joining us.
Well, thanks very much. It's always a pleasure to talk to you. And yeah, Let's hope that we get somewhere that Biden really does take on board that he needs to do as much as possible, because the outcome of the next election could be what happened with Obama, where I think pretty much Obama thought, well, Hillary can carry on with this job, and then was extremely surprised that in fact it was Donald Trump.
Yeah.